with us next Sunday evening for Leslie Spitzer's ordination service. The information about that is on the back of your bulletin. I hope you'll be present there. Also on the back of the bulletin, there is our circle luncheon, which is coming up this Saturday morning for lunch, or approaching the lunchtime hour. Now, circle luncheon, just in case you were wondering, it's not our geometric club here at First Baptist Newport News. No, our circle connection, our circles are mission small groups of ladies, and these ladies come together once a year for a luncheon together. And at that luncheon, what they do is they try to shine light on one area of mission that may not get as much light. So they are very forward-thinking in terms of the topics that they address. So this time, this next Saturday, they will be addressing, they have a special speaker, it's all listed in the bulletin for you there, who's going to be addressing the issue of human trafficking. And that issue is very prevalent in Newport News. It's very prevalent in Hampton Roads, all over Virginia. It is more and more of an issue. These young girls and young women, and also some young boys, these are desperate situations. And we have the opportunity to learn more and be a part of what God can do to redeem some of these lives. So, Beth Parker, if you'll raise your hand, Beth Parker here is our circle coordinator. She doesn't do triangles, she doesn't do squares, she just does circles, okay, in our church. And if you'd like to know more about the luncheon or more about our circles, our mission small groups, Bev will be out at the Welcome Center after this service, and you can talk to her. The luncheon's open for anybody, so you're welcome to come and be a part and learn about this ministry and this opportunity. Also, you may have noticed that we have a new sign. Y'all have seen the new sign out there? Okay, y'all may have noticed that it's on. It's just on in invisible lights, okay? So you kind of have to imagine a little bit, but it's going to be on soon. I want to encourage you, our sign raiser billboard is over here. We're about halfway toward our goal to paying for this sign, and the idea is that we've used some money from our savings account to pay for it, and we want to collect that money back in. So the idea, what are we doing with this sign? Well, this sign's going to allow us to share things that are going on within our church family with the community. It's going to allow us to be encouraging to our community. It's going to allow us at, one of the things I'm excited about is our staff will be able to change the messages on the sign without going outside. Can you imagine this winter? Instead of going outside in the snow, in the sub-zero temperatures, and the wind and the ice and everything that they've been changing the sign in, they're going to be able to be either in the office or even at home with a fire going, with hot tea, with crumpets, scones, all that other stuff, able to change the sign. It's a beautiful thing, and it will help save some time for our staff. So it's a way that we can share a word of encouragement to the community. Now, let's be real clear. Signs don't make people come to church, okay? You don't put a sign out there and say, okay, now everybody's going to come to church. That's not what happens. What the sign is for is to show people that we are hospitable and we are an encouraging community, and to invite folks to consider knowing what God is doing here and where they could be involved potentially. So if you feel led in that direction, we'd love to have you help us with that over and above your regular offerings. And soon it will be on with the non-invisible lights, which is better, right? Just saying, that's a little bit better. Now, moving on, going on into, we've been in a sermon series called Teachable Moments for the last few weeks. And Teachable Moments, we've got two more weeks in this series, just two more weeks. And the Teachable Moment we're going to focus on this week is actually one episode in the life of Jesus and his disciples. And we're going to break it down into two parts. One episode, and this episode is one of Jesus' road trips, right? It's a road trip. Now, Jesus and his disciples were often on road trips because that's how they got around. They walked everywhere. But this road trip was special. Anybody ever had a special road trip in their life? Yeah, special road trips. You know what road trips are, right? Somebody, yeah, when you're in college, somebody yelled, road trip. It didn't matter what time of day it was, you went. That also happens, by the way, with empty nesters and retirees. They just often do it with RVs, okay, and with trailers and other things. Road trips, it's all kinds of fun, all right? So Jesus is on a road trip with his disciples. This is Matthew 16. We're about to get to the text. But before we get there, I want to show you something. I've got a map here that I happen to bring with me. It's a little bit hard to see, but we've got two red rectangles there that are going to help us out a little bit. Jesus, on this road trip, is in a place called Caesarea Philippi, which is that very top reddish rectangle almost off the screen up there. Caesarea Philippi. Now, Jesus does not go there a lot, according to the scriptures. It's about 25 miles away from Capernaum, which is their main spot where their main headquarters are as Jesus and the disciples move in. And Capernaum is right at the top of this top little piece of water called the Sea of Galilee up there. There's two pieces of water at the top, Sea of Galilee. The bigger piece down at the bottom is the Dead Sea. And of course, on the left side, the Mediterranean Sea. Up at the top of the Sea of Galilee, that's kind of where Jesus hung out a lot. All of Jesus' main ministry is taking place between the two bodies of water there. The Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. Jerusalem's over there, Jericho's over there. All around the Sea of Galilee, Jesus does lots of teaching there. Nazareth is over off to the left of the Sea of Galilee. All of Jesus' main ministry happens between the two bodies of water. In this story, Jesus is up there at the top red rectangle, Caesarea Philippi, which, just in case you're wondering, is in the modern-day Golan Heights. There's some activity that happens there you may be aware of. And as a matter of fact, in today, that site today of Caesarea Philippi is just almost at Lebanon. So it's very close to the border of Lebanon over there up on the Golan Heights. And this area was, Jesus and his disciples are walking through it. It's about 25 miles from their main walking area. Have you ever noticed, by the way, if you're out driving, there may be a restaurant or a grocery store or something that's close to where you live, but if you don't ever drive in that direction, you don't ever go there. You ever notice that? We tend to follow our regular driving commute patterns. Even if something's close by, we don't necessarily end up over there. This is only 25 miles away, which is a lot when you're walking, I get it. But it's only 25 miles away, but it's not the direction that Jesus and the disciples normally go. Caesarea Philippi is also a place with very few Jewish people. It is primarily Gentile, primarily pagan. It is filled with folks of various degrees of Roman citizenry and various degrees of Roman Empire connection. It is a city with strong emperor worship. It is a city connected to Caesar. Obviously, Caesarea came from Caesar's name. But Philippi was the name of Philip the Tetrarch, who was Herod the Great's son. Herod the Great's empire was divided among his four sons, and Philip was a mini-king, a tetrarch, and he had like one-fifth of the empire, so there you go, one-fourth of the empire. And he's got this little place, so it's named Caesarea Philippi. Why do you name a city two things? Well, you've got another red box down there. You see that other red box over there? That's Caesarea. Imagine telling your friends, hey, we're going to meet at Caesarea, and you go to the beach, and they go to Caesarea Philippi up in the mountains. That's awkward. Your road trip ends up in two different places. So they called this Caesarea Philippi to distinguish it from Caesarea, which is all the way down here on the coast. All this to say that Jesus and his disciples are walking around in a place that is not where they normally are. It's in a place that is very pagan. It is in a place where Roman emperor worship is very profound. It is in a place that has a great deal of understanding of Greek mythology. Matter of fact, there are a lot of shrines to the Greek god Pan up in this area. It is, for something located as close to Judea as it is as cosmopolitan as one can find, with very little Jewish population. This makes it an intriguing setting for what Jesus is about to do. Let's read the text together if you will with me. We've got it on the screen. You might have it in your Bibles, or you can use one of the Bibles in front of you. We're going from Matthew 16, starting with verse 13. It says, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do you say that the Son of Man is? They replied, some say you're John the Baptist. Others say you're Elijah. Still others say you're Jeremiah or one of the prophets. But what about you, Jesus asked? Who do you say I am? Simon Peter answered, you are Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, For this was not revealed to you by man, but my Father who is in heaven. I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Some versions say will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Then he warned his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Christ. By the way, just in case you had never thought about it or you didn't know, Jesus was not the son of Joseph and Mary Christ. That is not Jesus' last name. Okay? It's actually better translated Jesus the Christ, because Christ is actually a title, and it is the Greek version of the word Messiah, which means anointed one, the one anointed from God that will save God's people. So Peter calling him the Christ was saying, you are the Messiah. You are the Son of God, the one we have been looking for centuries. Jesus, as a teacher, was a master. He also had a great sense of irony. Here he is asking his disciples to say who he is, asking them to say, who will you follow? Where does your power rest? And he's standing here in the principal place of power for the whole region. He's standing here in the imperial place of power, the place where the emperors were worshipped, the place of Roman power, the place of the Roman governor in this province. And Jesus is asking, who do you say that I am? With the underlying question, who will you follow? Friends, this is a scenario about power. It's a strange place for a Jewish Messiah to make a proclamation that he is the one they've been looking for when there's no Jewish people around. And yet it is right here in Caesarea Philippi, this place where two other entities claimed primacy and claimed power, where Jesus says, who do you say I am? Who do you say, disciples, has the power? I don't know about your family, but my experience is that incredible conversations and moments of conviction happen on road trips. Maybe moments of character building, just like for these disciples, happen on road trips. Because these disciples, just on an ordinary trip, are all of a sudden thrust into a conversation that will define and redefine the rest of their lives and the rest of their eternities. And maybe you've realized that on certain road trips, there are moments of deep choice and deep conviction and deep character building as well. Maybe you've had one of those road trips. A few years ago, our family traveled to New York and Boston and Maine for vacation. Now, we organized this trip so that we took Amtrak to New York, and then we took Megabus to Boston. Has anybody ever ridden on a Megabus before? That's an experience for a whole nother sermon. We'll talk about that. It's a good thing. If you haven't done it, you ought to do it. It's worth talking about. We got to Boston on the Megabus, spent a few days there, so we had already gone through a little over half our vacation, and we hadn't even gotten a car yet. But to get to Maine, you have to get the car, so we rented a car. Alice went and picked up the car, brought it back to the hotel. We loaded all of our stuff up in the car, and then we had to go back to the rental car agency because she and I were both on the account, so we both had to sign the document. So we get in there, we pull into a parking space, about the only parking spaces in this parking lot. There's this little sign up there that says tow away zone, which, you know, we're looking at it going, you know, it's the only spots in the rental car parking lot. So obviously they're trying to keep people from parking in the rental car spots, right? So parked in one of those with our rental car. I went in, left Alice and the kids in the car, went in to sign, and the person said, oh, your wife needs to be in here too. She's already signed. Well, we need to have both of you here. Okay, so I go out and tell Alice. She hoofs the three kids, who are much younger at that time, in there with us. It takes us all of 2 or 3 minutes to sign things, and we come back out the door just in time to see our rental car loaded up on the back of a flatbed tow truck. with all of our luggage, with all of our stuff, with all of our beloved stuffed animals, with every mobile device that we had, with every bit of sweet tea that I had made, because you know you can't buy that in Boston, and all of this stuff in our car, and the tow truck slowly starting to pull away. Well, all five of us uttered appropriate things, and I immediately set off in a sprint and managed to catch the tow truck driver before he turned on the road. We introduced ourselves and exchanged pleasantries, and then began a conversation about the situation we discovered ourselves in. I pointed out that we had a rental car, and this was the rental car lot. He said to me, well, the rental car folks called me and said somebody was parked in their lot in a tow-away zone. I said, it's their rental car. He said, I don't think they care, and I know I don't care. I said, this doesn't sound very forgiving and kind. He said, it's not supposed to. And on we went with this conversation. The conversation ended with him gently setting down our rental car in the parking lot after we had made some transactional arrangements together that I later filed in our spreadsheet as miscellaneous expenses. Frayed but unshaken, we all got in the car and began moving out toward Maine. We quickly arrived in traffic that lasted for about two states, and thankfully New Hampshire's a small state, but even so. And so as we're going through, about 40 minutes into this, one of the children decides it's a good time to throw up, which is kind of how I felt too, honestly. So Alice and I were cleaning off our child, cleaning out the back seat of the car, cleaning out everything else that was happening in there. And we looked at each other and said, it doesn't get any better than this. This is why you do vacation, to have experiences like this together as a family. We grunted to each other. We got things cleaned up, got to where we were staying for the night, which is a whole other story for another sermon. And the next morning, we got up, and we all kind of looked at each other and said, you know what? We've got a choice here. Either we can let that day from Hades that we just experienced yesterday be the defining feeling of the rest of our vacation, or we can go forward and we can have a great time for the rest of this trip and do the best we can to just only remember that day as a sermon story I will tell one day. And we decided as a family that we were going to move forward. And we had a great rest of the trip. But friends, it took a decision on our part to say we are not going to dwell on how bad that was, because it was not fun. That is a day I don't ever want to relive. I don't like reliving the memories of it. But it was a moment of character building for us as a family to be able to decide and say, we're going forward. Whatever else happens, we're going forward, and we're going to remember, and we're going to live, and we're going to enjoy what God has provided for us here. Now, friends, Peter and his friends, they have a choice to make here. They are on the road with Jesus, and Jesus has just hit them between the eyes with the question of a lifetime. The question is very simply, who do you say that I am? You, friends, have been walking with me, Jesus says, for months. You've been watching me heal. You've been hearing me teach. You've been listening to me as I have done all these things. Now's the time. Who am I? Not what everybody else says. Not what you're postulating in your mind. Who am I? And Peter says, Jesus, you are the Christ. You are the one we have been searching for. You are the only one that can offer us, as he says in the Gospel of John, you're the only one that offers us the words of life. And I will put my life in your hands. Friends, wherever you are in life, wherever your journey is today, whatever road you are on, whatever you are wrestling with, you and I all have the same question. Who do we say Jesus is? And what are we going to do with him? Because you see, friends, it's not just enough to say that Jesus is the Son of God. It's not just enough to say, I believe that Jesus died on the cross to forgive my sins. It's not enough, friends, to just believe the right things. What Jesus asks us to do is follow him. He asks us to give our lives into his leadership and into his directions and follow him with each step with everything we have, to be completely remade until our attitudes, our hearts, and our love look like his. It is the question for a lifetime, and it all happened on a simple road trip that was like any other, except that they were in a place of power. And Jesus, friends, make no mistake, this is not an accident that he asked this question here. Because what he's asking of them is, disciples, will you follow me? Will you make me your only allegiance? Not to any other government, not to Caesar, not to Philip, not to any other government, not to any other corporation, not to any other motive, not to any other priority. Will you make all of your life subservient to me as your leader? Will you make your relationships live underneath me as their leader? Will you make your earnings and your profiting and your work life submitted under the leadership of Jesus Christ? Will you make your political views, your government submitted under the leadership of Jesus Christ? Will you submit all of your life under Jesus Christ and say beyond everything else, I will follow Jesus and I will follow no one else because he is the one I will bank my life on? Who is Jesus to you? And will you follow him? I guess there's a lot of different answers to that question. There are folks who answer the question, Jesus was a good man. He's a good teacher. Many of his things are things that we can live by. But we're not seeing him as the Son of God, seeing him as the one I will follow with my life. I'm just going to take a little bit of Jesus' teaching and some teaching from other places, and I'm going to make the best spirituality for me. That's out there. There are other folks who say, Jesus wasn't even a historical person. He didn't even exist. And there are plenty of folks out there who say that. Now, decision, but I will have to point out your perspective. It is your life. It's your decision. But I will have to point out to you, if you want to make that claim, you are going to have to make that claim in spite of the fact that there is piles of historical evidence that talk about the existence of Jesus, not least of which is the community that was founded upon who he was and who he is. But friends, at the end of the day, every single one of us has to choose. And not, friends, not just choose to believe in Jesus, not just choose to believe the right statements about Jesus, but to choose to invest your life in the pursuit of nothing but Jesus. That your pursuit of Jesus will impact how you love your spouse, how you love your children, how you choose your job, how you choose your mate, how you spend your money, how you do every single thing you do. What do you choose to guide and direct your life? And Peter says, Jesus, I choose you. And Jesus says, Peter, on that confession right there, I will build the church. On that confession right there, I will build the church. By the way, do you know Jesus only uses the word church twice? I mean, it's the word ekklesia, it's the Greek word. He only uses it twice. Matthew 16, I believe Matthew 17. He only uses it twice. Church literally means the called out ones. The community called out, to use John's language, called out of darkness into the light of Jesus Christ. We are the called out community of God, which means that in order to be a part of the church of Jesus Christ, you submit your life to following Jesus Christ. This is not joining an institution, not joining an organization, not simply signing on some form. When you decide to become a part of the family of God, when you decide to be a part of the church, it is because you have decided to make Jesus the leader, the forgiver of your sin, and the leader of every arena of your life. That is what the church is built on, the confession. Not just Peter's confession. Peter's confession models for all of us what we do. Making our lives belong to God in Jesus Christ. That's the church. Not a building, not a budget, not a growth graph, not a list of programs, a list of classes, not where you sit on Sunday morning. That's not the church. The church is the people of God who have bound together to say that because we are committed fully and only to Jesus Christ, we will love Him and we will come together in community to love one another and love our world toward Jesus. So you look around the room. These are the people you have bonded your life to, whether you know them or not. These aren't the people on a roster, on a roll with you. You've bonded your life to them. Because you've said that in Jesus Christ we are one and we are going to do the mission of God. And what is the mission of God? To live in the world telling and living with love the truth that all people matter to God. And that all people matter to God the same. And to live it and love it and invite people toward Jesus with every breath. That's what we do. That's the church. It's a very inspiring statement in this text. This statement says, on this rock, on Peter's confession, I will build my church. And, you ready? And the gates of Hades will not prevail against the church. It's interesting, he uses the gates of Hades, a Greek phrase. Well, the word Hades, the name of the Greek god of the underworld, it's in the original, it's in the Greek text of the scriptures, so it's not a translation error. It's actually there. The gates of Hades, the most accurate translation of that passage. Interestingly enough, Caesarea Philippi was fed by an underground spring, kind of an underground river, and it had its starting place up near Mount Hermon, and there's a big cave opening entrance there, and it was a dark opening with a river flowing out of it. Legend in the community said that was one of the entrance ways to the river Styx. Anybody remember their Greek mythology? The river Styx is what led to the underground, the river that led to the place of the dead. The lair of Hades, the god of death, the god of the underworld. So in that era, that area of the world, Caesarea Philippi, that cave was known as the gates of Hades. Jesus was a master teacher. I have no doubt that he said, when he said in the gates of Hades, I have no doubt he pointed to them, or at least pointed in that direction. The gates of Hades himself will not prevail against my church. What a powerful picture. The gates of Hades will not prevail against the church. That may be a little bit hard to believe in this day and age, because we live in something called a postmodern era. We live in a postmodern era. What does that mean? Well, let me just give you a couple of things that have happened in this era. For the last 40 years, church attendance in the United States of America has declined. In the last, since 2010, it's declined at a more precipitous rate than ever. Southern Baptist Convention years ago used to say that, you know, it's only the quote-unquote liberal denominations that are shrinking. How did they define liberal denominations and liberal churches? Oh, those are the ones that ordain women. Okay, I'm not making this up. This is really out there. And those are the ones that are shrinking. Well, friends, even the Southern Baptist Convention has had to admit lately, they're shrinking too. As a matter of fact, last year, Southern Baptist Convention churches baptized fewer people than any year since the 1930s. And guess what? There are a lot more Americans around now than there were in the 1930s. We have lost in the Southern Baptist Convention over 800,000 members since 2010. Churches have declined over the last 40 years. Attendance has declined. On any given week, 17.8% of Americans are in church. Millennials, less than 10% of millennials go to church. And let's not even start talking about Generation Z, the generation just below. This is where we are. This is the world we're in. Churches are shrinking. Churches are closing in the United States of America. Thousands of them. We've experienced that in our own community. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of sanctuaries where people look around each Sunday and say, there used to be more people here. There are thousands of churches in the United States where the high attendance marker for the church was in the 1960s. And we look around and we see churches empty. We see some churches full and big, but what statistics tell us now and what we've learned about megachurches now is 81% of folks who are a part of megachurches came from another church. Many of them smaller churches that were struggling, or maybe there was a fight or something like that and they ended up there. That's not picking on megachurches, that's just the way it is. They didn't start out to do that. That wasn't their plan. All that to say, we look at the state of the church now and we think, holy cow. And we look at Western Europe. We look at empty cathedrals. We look in places where in Spain, the place they used to call more Catholic than the Pope, a fifth of the population in Spain claims to be atheist. Friends, we need to understand something. The institution of the church is not the church. Our buildings are not the church. Our roles are not the church. Building an organization is not what Jesus was talking about. Building an institution is not what Jesus was talking about. What he was saying was very simply, in every single era, maybe attendances rise and attendances fall or whatever else, whatever the church goes through, the church of Jesus Christ will not falter. It will prevail because at the end of the day, we're not talking about four walls. We're not talking about stones. We're not talking about budgets. We're talking about the call of people to follow Jesus Christ, to make him their leader, and to change the world because of his love. That's the church. People bound together, and that church will not fail. Now, it will change. We're sitting around in 2050, and I'm 80 years old, Lord willing. And everyone on these front pews here are the ones in charge of the church. It's going to look way different. There are going to be way fewer buildings. It's going to be a whole different church. And the church will prevail over the gates of Hades. Because the church is God's people. It's not the people's building. And we need to understand that. We need to get a hold of that. Because friends, at the end of the day, we're called to be together as the people of God. We're called not to be a denomination, not to be an organization. We're called to be the world's inspiration toward Jesus. That's us. If all of this was gone, you and me, we'd still be the church. Thanks be to God. We come to the table of God with two questions on our hearts. Who is Jesus? And will we be the church?